On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Super investor Warren Buffett, the famed sage of Omaha, had never invested in a company abroad before. Last week, he did, with big-time billions and a tough message. The USA does not have its house in order, and he's looking to invest overseas. So are millions of other Americans. While U.S. stocks have poked along, foreign markets have zoomed, and American dollars have followed. So far this year, U.S. investors have poured twice as much into international mutual funds as U.S. funds. 70% of new investment money is rushing abroad. It's a tidal wave, a vote of confidence in other economies, and of doubt about our own. Up next on Point, American dollars rushing everywhere else, and what it means for you. Joining me first today from New York is Karen Richardson. She's a staff writer for The Wall Street Journal. And Warren Buffett and his investment house, Berkshire Hathaway, is her beat. Karen, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
So for starters, that's all you cover, Warren Buffett and his company.
That's the main thing I cover. I also write other financial news for a column.
But that's the bulk of it. And remind us, give us the history here. Why is he such a big deal? His company such a big deal? Warren Buffett such a bellwether?
His company, first of all, I mean, he's just got an incredibly long track record. I mean, if we take a look at a lot of people on Wall Street today, you know, hedge funds and stuff out there, I mean, we're talking maybe a decade long or whatever. You know, he's been, his partnership, I mean, he was, you know, 1957, I mean, he started talking to people about investing, and his stock, I mean, he's built up the stock, the share price of Berkshire Hathaway to, I think, almost $90,000 per share.
Per share. And over 40 years, I'm reading here in your story, Berkshire's book value has grown an average annual rate of 21.5%. Not bad over 40 years.
Yeah, exactly. So it's really his investment record. And one last thing is that, you know, he invests the way that we're all taught that you're supposed to invest, which is to buy and hold. And he's been able to achieve those returns by doing exactly that.
And he's got an unbelievable number of big American companies in his portfolio, major shares, and you name them, Coca-Cola.
Sure, exactly. Coca-Cola, he's got American Express. He has, you know, H&R Block. I mean, names that we all know and that's not even including the companies, the whole companies that he owns in his own, you know, he has 40-plus companies.
Lots and lots and lots of big American companies. Last weekend was their big annual get-together in Omaha, Nebraska. They call it the Woodstock of capitalism.
That's right.
Meets the sage of Omaha. 24,000 people with money came to listen to him. And as you reported, one of the things that he's saying, and he put his money where his mouth is with this latest investment, is he, Warren Buffett, is looking kind of for the first time abroad.
Yes. In terms of, you know, he's always looking around the world, from what I understand and what he's told us, is that he, you know, he's open to buying everywhere. This is the first time that he's actually bought a company headquartered outside the United States and bought that company wholesale. Now, I think that he's probably looked at companies in the past, but this is the first time he's actually gone ahead and done it. And it you know, quality of the company is really high, so he's doing it for that reason. But he also has other reasons, in terms of his view of the dollar.
We'll talk about that, but first the company, $4 billion for an 80% stake in what, you tell us?
Yes, it's an Israeli company called Iskar Limited, and it's a, you know, family company, family-owned company, the Wertheimer family, and they make metal cutting tools. So if you think about all the things that, you know, the cars and all everything, that any kind of piece of metal that needs to be cut, I mean, they make the, you know, the blades. And some of those blades, you know, need to be replaced every minute or every few minutes. And that's what they do. And they have, they've got a huge plant, or that they call it a manufacturing campus,
right,
in Israel. That's the biggest one.
Mm-hmm.
And that they also have facilities in Korea and in Brazil and China and Germany.
And they sell on the model of Gillette, where Warren Buffett, through Procter & Gamble, also has a big stake. That is, you have to keep buying these metal cutting blades. So this is something Buffett knows, and he likes to know what he invests in.
Right. I mean, Gillette, Gillette's much more on it's disposable blades, but it's much more on the sort of consumer side. This is much more on the corporate, like industrial side.
Sure, so, but the model here is keep buying those big industrial blades. And the bigger critique of the American economy that has Warren Buffett talking about looking abroad, remind us?
Sure. He's been talking about this for a couple of years, but it is that the government's borrowing a lot overseas, relying on foreign countries such as China and Japan and Korea to buy treasury bonds. What's happened is that the deficit has just grown and grown. Trade deficit as well is growing other countries are using the money there's just lots and lots of trade dollars.
So billions every day that America is counting on a foreign investment. Warren Buffett is looking out and he sees trouble for the U.S. economy. With these great deficits, he's saying the dollar could go way down and American inflation could go way up. So he sees opportunity abroad and trouble ahead here.
Yes, I mean, but I should note also that that's true. But he is highly invested in the United States.
Sure,
I mean, it's not like he's
he spent 40 years doing it. He's got some chips on the table here.
Exactly, it's not as if he's saying, "I've got 40 plus companies, and they're all based in the U.S. Now I think it's time for me to move them all overseas." It's not the case. In fact, he is by far much more much more of the earnings for Berkshire Hathaway come from the United States, and they are denominated in dollars.
So in a way, he's a lagging indicator here. Big investors are way ahead of Warren Buffett in moving dollars overseas.
You could say that. I mean, let's remember in 2002, in early 2002, he started betting against the dollar by buying foreign exchange contracts in 2002. And he's got a lot of flack for that last year, when the dollar increased.
Actually strengthened.
Mm-hmm. Got tons of flack for that. I mean, people were, giving him a hard time and, what's he doing? Why is he betting on foreign
currency? Sort of selling short the USA. How has that actually worked out for him?
Exactly. He's actually net positive $2 billion on that deal, on that
bet. Not too bad.
Yeah, and so he's actually been trimming that position. It was about $21 billion, and I think he brought it down to below $15 billion. And what he's done instead is, he's buying, directly into foreign stocks, and as we know with the S-Car deal, foreign companies.
So to protect his flank, and now a foreign company, and the message from Warren Buffett, the sage of Omaha, to the United States about how to get its house in order, what would he like to see in a nutshell?
Well, I think he would, like to see the government change its fiscal policy and not be borrowing so much. I think that was one of the things that he came out with in the meeting. I mean, he said this a lot. He just says that we have this habit of borrowing, and we need to stop doing that, basically. I mean, and I think mainly he's talking about the government. There's obviously a lot of borrowing going on in the domestic market, consumer borrowing. But,
sure.
Really it has to do with, the amount of treasury bonds that are being bought and picked up by other countries.
And he's looking overseas. Karen Richardson, who covers Warren Buffett night and day all year round. Thanks for your report on the latest from the Sage of Omaha. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Great. Thank you, Tom.
Karen Richardson, staff reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Joining me now in the studio is big money investor James Jempel. He's manager of Height Hedge LP, a hedge fund based in Boston. James Jempel, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom, for having me.
So Americans are sending a lot of dollars abroad, and investment advisors are encouraging them to do that. Why this huge flow, way, way up over what it's been?
Well, I think we're in a bit of a brave new world here. We've left behind the relative certainty from an investing standpoint of the Cold War era, and we've left behind the giddiness of the internet bubble. And now what we've got going on here, I think, is a global tug of war on the supply side. We've got between the boom of hundreds of millions of Chinese going from literally planting rice in the ground by hand to making things in factories that we all need to buy.
Very successfully.
Mm-hmm. Indians staffing call centers and research complexes in India. And so there's a tug of war between the increased productivity of the developing world and the supply drag of the oil markets.
So when you look forward, you're a big investor, a hedge fund, you've got to bring in great returns. Where do you see the best returns in the years ahead, in the United States or abroad?
Well, I think when you're looking forward, there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty here in terms of what's going to happen in this global tug of war. But the one thing seems relatively certain, that we owe big time as a country. And
To China and everybody else.
To China and everyone else. And it will be essentially an irresistible force to inflate our way out of this problem.
That is, you make dollars worth less, so it's easier to pay off the debt.
Yeah, we literally just print the money. We own the press.
You've said you're worried about the potential collapse of demand in the United States coming out of that cycle. How?
Well,
why?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, that could be one of the things that could hurt domestic companies that focus on domestic production.
Paint
here.
The picture, sort of connect the dots. What would lead to that collapse of demand?
Well, what could happen is that you could see essentially what they're calling now the zombie consumer essentially run out of gas. That, you know, there's no savings left. The equity has been withdrawn from the homes. Salaries aren't increasing. And essentially they just, facing inflationary pressures that would be brought about by a decline in the dollar and the increase in import prices,
mm-hmm.
they just would have really purchasing power decline. And if the demand were to collapse in the United States, it would be very bad.
And if the money, the investment money, the smart money like yours goes abroad, chooses not to invest here where growth is 4% and that's considered good, but abroad where it might be 8 or 9 or 10%.
Yes.
Does that come back and feed the United States, or does that bleed the United States of the capital it needs to compete?
Well, it is in some sense a capital bleed. I mean, what you're looking to do when you're investing is looking for future productivity growth. And, all signs would indicate that productivity growth will be faster overseas. I mean, why risk yourself on the dollar when you don't have to, when it's so easy now for practically anyone to invest overseas with the innovation of some of the financial products we've seen?
A couple of years ago, we talked with a celebrated business philosopher, I guess you could call him, Peter Drucker, about the future of the United States and the U.S. economy. He died last November. But let's listen to what he said about how the U.S. economy was on the track to become just one among many strong economies.
And our world economy is emerging again, in which America is not even the foremost power. That's probably the European Economic Union rapidly. And we will have to learn to be half a dozen major players. And America's role in the world increasingly will have to be one of equals.
The great Peter Drucker from his last broadcast interview with us here on Point. I've been joined in the studio by James Jampel, manager of Height Hedge LP, a hedge fund based in Boston. We're joined right now from New York by Michael Mandel, chief economist for Businessweek magazine. Michael Mandel, good to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
So you're watching, along with everybody else, this huge push of dollars abroad. Everybody's advising their clients now to have a good exposure in foreign markets. I mean, it's a globalized economy. It makes sense people would invest everywhere. They've been investing here from abroad for a long time. Is this a good thing, a bad thing, a neutral thing for the United States? And what kind of indicator is it, Michael Mandel?
Well, you have to realize that financial advisors have been telling people to invest overseas for 20 years. This is really not anything new.
Well, but the volume is certainly new.
I wouldn't be excessively impressed by the volume. If you look at the total volume of money flowing around the world at this point, much more is coming into the U.S. than is going out. That's really the major fact. I wanted to say something about Warren Buffett here. You know, he's been a pessimist on the U.S. economy
mm-hmm.
for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
He was really negative on the new economy in the 1990s, and he was anti-technology. So this attitude of Buffett towards the U.S. is not anything new.
Twice as much money going into international mutual funds most recently than in U.S. funds, 70% of new money going abroad. That sounds like a pretty strong push to me, Michael Mandel.
You know, if you look at these money flows, you could move back a few years, they flow back, they change. They fluctuate with the trends. Right now, U.S. Foreign stock markets are doing a lot better than U.S. stock markets, and so the money's moving abroad. It's easy for financial advisors to say, look, why don't you invest over there? All you need is a little bit of a financial crisis to sort of make the money flow back again.
James Jampel, no big deal. Warren Buffett's been sour for a long time. The collapse of demand, not a real threat here. Money ebbs and flows. No major change.
No, I guess I disagree. I think that the flows overseas are really going to be much more persistent. It's really much easier to invest overseas, and the proportion that Americans have invested overseas is still has plenty of room to grow. I think that, you know, when we were talking 20 years ago, people were saying, you know, you need a 5 or 10% overseas allocation.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think the thinking is trending much more towards how a European investor might feel, which is that, yeah, I might have a sum of my investments in Europe, but I need to be in the United States. I need to be in Japan. I need to be in Australia. And I think with the increasing globalization here and the decreasing sort of geopolitical risk from an investing side in mm-hmm. places like China, which is not going to take a great leap backward or anything like that, the offshore push should only grow.
Michael Mendez, how do you see this working? How do you see it working out long term? It's a global economy, so money flows all over the place and everyone's fine. Or the U.S. has big deficits, current account deficit, fiscal deficits. The dollar could take a precipitous plunge and we've got problems here.
I don't think anything horrible happening here. The reason why, if you think about, there's two aspects in investing. One is productivity growth, and the other is safety and risk. The U.S. has had much better productivity growth than either Japan or Europe. So when you had Peter Drucker's statement about the U.S. competing with the European Union, mm-hmm. right now the U.S. looks a lot better
yep.
than Europe, has looked a lot better than Japan. You can compare U.S. growth with China and India, and of course U.S. growth is slower. But if you ask the question about geopolitical risk, U.S. versus China, U.S. versus India, well, you're left with the feeling that right now things are safe. If you have a financial crisis, you have a global financial crisis, in fact, a lot of the money is going to flow back to the U.S. again. It seems that the U.S. right now occupies a sweet spot, strong growth, strong relative safety. I know that a lot of people seem worried about the budget deficit. I know a lot of people seem worried about the borrowing. But if you put it in context of the rapid growth of productivity, you're left sort of saying this is a manageable problem.
James Jumpelt, manageable problem? You're managing a lot of money. Are you managing it toward the U.S. in the future or managing it abroad?
Well, perhaps. I mean, some of the stability that we've seen, I think, is a function of the Chinese and the Japanese and the Koreans really having nowhere else to go with their treasuries. They're very large holders, and they really have nowhere else to put their money.
They take these huge profits. They have to park it somewhere. The United States has been the parking place of choice.
Exactly. But as a normal American investor, you are not large, and you can go anywhere you want. And, you know, with the ease, you know, if you're looking for rule of law, financial discipline, land of opportunity, it's, without the structural problems, you can either go north to Canada or south to Australia if you want to stay in English-speaking places. It's really easy to do that. And so, you know, what I tell some people is, you know, just park it up in Canada and leave it there if you're worried about geopolitical risk.
And it's going in large numbers. Let's bring our listeners in. Edison is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Edison. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about one of the reasons why I started investing my money in foreign markets.
Mm-hmm.
It basically started back in the Enron and WorldCom scandals that really shook my trust in the financial markets stateside,
right,
and made me want to look for other options.
And so where did you go, Edison? Where's your money now overseas?
Well, I've been investing in mutual funds that are in China. They're investing in India and in Brazil. Basically, a lot of emerging markets that are up and coming, and they're doing very well. But I do keep a close eye on them.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. And what do you think long-term, Edison? Do you think, are you going to look more and more abroad? Do you trust that the U.S. will come back as a target of choice for your investments?
Well, I'm a young investor right now, so I don't have that many worries in things that are risky. So I think I'm going to stay abroad for probably the foreseeable future. I can't see any reason to come back here and earn 9-10% a year when I can be doing double that or abroad.
And 9 or 10 would be pretty good a year. You're talking high numbers there, and good on you. Let's get another call from San Francisco. David's on the line. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Yeah. How are you? It's my understanding that the International Monetary Fund was created to prevent currency speculators. These were the parasites of the world that were essentially creating. There was no actual production of goods or services. It was simply people who would insult one nation one week, buy that currency low, and then they would praise that nation a week later in order to prop up its economy.
An awful lot of people do currency trading these days.
Right, but what the reality is that it's a race to the bottom, as Ralph Nader would call it. It just creates utter poverty in the world while these guys get to not only do they insult one nation and then praise it, but it justifies the hunkering down of a military economy in order to defend against these insults and to artificially boost one's pride. They
of course,
have to develop a military. So it
maybe, but it depends on those who have a big enough megaphone to really drive down a currency. Not many of those. But Michael Mandel, look at the speculation around currency now. People worried about the dollar, and then it came back strong last year. And still, with the big deficits, there's a long-term worry about it. Do you hear investment advisors saying, Americans, hedge your bets by having foreign currencies in your portfolio?
No, I don't hear them saying that. What I do think is that it's possible that the dollar will slide over time. I wouldn't be surprised to see that. But really, the experience has been that currency crises come up quickly. They come up surprisingly. You really can't tell where they're going to hit. And what I worried about is actually the previous caller who was talking about getting 20% returns in China and India.
Mm.
And when I hear that, little alarm bells go off for me because, as you know, when people go out searching for those kind of high returns, they're really not factoring in the degree of risk.
And, of course, at
That's
this point, some of the wise guys are saying that so much money has gone abroad that it may be toppy. It may be this opportunity may be peaking out for those big returns abroad.
The way you want to think about it is this. You look at the country in terms of, I like the term geopolitical risk. The U.S. is incredibly stable. China and India are still developing countries. They are still slowly putting in the rule of law. China has a massive underlying political problem. And if you want to think about in the sort of the 10-year framework, I'd be very surprised to not see a political economic crisis in China that has a major effect over the next 10 years.
And yet I do read, you may not, but I see all kinds of investors saying, Americans, you want some other currencies in your bucket. Front page of the Wall Street Journal today is dollar weakens, more investors snap up debt in local, that is foreign currencies. I mean, you see that pressure out there. Let me get a call from Natick, Massachusetts. David's on the air. Hi, David. You're on the line.
Hello there.
Hi.
Well, in Eastern Europe, we see Putin using the power of his oil to affect the politics of Eastern Europe. And you can imagine that if the United States got involved with China, a little dispute over Taiwan or even North Korea, that the Chinese would find it, even though the economists would tell you they'd lose money by dumping a lot of their U.S. holdings because they'd have to sell them more and more cheaply, that's a lot cheaper than going to war, and they could have a lot of influence on us by threatening or actually doing so.
So China's got leverage. What about it?
So, well, what would happen if they withdrew a lot of their investment in U.S. bonds and in U.S. properties?
James Jempel?
What would happen to our economy?
James?
Yeah, I think I don't know if that the scenario described is a realistic one, but if it were to happen, and stranger things have happened, I think it would be a very bad situation for us here in the U.S. I really think the American investors got to change their mindset about where they invest their money and look much more overseas. I mean, if you're going to have your paycheck tied to this economy, why on earth would you want to have your investment returns also tied to this economy? At least you can own a share in the overseas venture that downsizes your job.
Here's my question. This may be a fool's question, but let me ask it. We've got a great concentration of wealth in this country. That's a lot of capital that's free to flow around. If the returns are so much better abroad, and they have been recently anyway, Michael Mandel's right, that can all change and perhaps will. But could we see a situation where you concentrate this wealth and then ship it overseas? And we don't have the capital in this country that we need to retool to kind of see the economy gear up again. Is that...
On a 20-year basis, the U.S. Returns are higher than overseas returns.
Yeah, but 20 years ago, China was nothing.
Oh, I understand that. But then you really have to think about every time you say return, you have to put the word risk in your head because these two things really go around.
What about the risk right here at home? We've got deficits through the ceiling. China could call a couple of cards and send it rocking. Warren Buffett thinks the dollar could plummet. He's not alone in that.
The deficits are still a relatively small share of the economy at this point. And the fact is, despite all of the overseas borrowing we've been doing, U.S. wealth, U.S. net worth has been rising because of the high productivity growth. The biggest danger right now to the U.S. is actually doesn't have anything to do with currencies, doesn't have anything to do with foreign competition, has a lot more to do with whether or not we can continue our own innovation and productivity growth. That's where the possibility for failure comes.
Let me bring another voice into this conversation from Vancouver, Canada. Mark Zandi's with us. He's chief economist and co-founder of MoodysEconomy.com. Mr. Zandi, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So help us figure this out. Big flow of American investment dollars abroad. We've got a global economy. Maybe that's a great thing. Maybe it's not. How do you see it? Is this capital flight? Is this just a healthy global economy at work?
I think it's the latter. I think it's a reflection of a strong global economy. We do have our problems. The deficit fiscal situation will be an increasingly significant one, and we need to resolve that and address it. But I do think globalization has been very good to us and will continue to be very good to us.
Could the capital flow abroad undermine the U.S. economy, or is that just, giving ourselves nightmares unnecessarily?
Unnecessary nightmares. We're the beneficiaries of tremendous capital flows. In fact, if you look at global investment, we get more than our fair share, and I don't see any reason why that will stop anytime soon. As Michael pointed out, we're a very, very safe place to invest and a much safer place than anywhere else to invest, and that will remain the case long into the future.
How does all this factor into income and wealth inequality? That's been growing in the United States. Does this global capital flow have an effect on that?
Yeah, that's a good point. The globalization process, I think, has led to a skewing of the distribution of income and wealth. The benefits of globalization accrue to a fairly narrow group of people here in our economy. And we need to think about that more carefully and work to ensure that that does not continue. So that is an issue, and I think it will become a growing problem in the future.
Is there a risk in that for the U.S. economy, in that equality, either economically or politically?
Yeah, it is a risk for many reasons. I think if the inequality continues to grow, at some point it's going to be a weight on our ability to grow quickly. And moreover, the folks that are not benefiting from this process, who are being hurt by the process, could actually short-circuit it. We can get a sense of that in the recent debate over immigration policy. Clearly people are being hurt by the process of globalization, and if we don't help them get through this, everyone's going to get hurt because the process of globalization will be short-circuited through the political process.
That is, go to the polls and vote for someone who promises them to throw a monkey wrench in here and slow it up, stop it.
Exactly.
And that, to your mind, a problem. What are you hearing people advising investors these days in terms of what portion of portfolio ought to be overseas, Mark Zandi?
Well, I think there is a clear effort by managers to have their investors move overseas, to diversify their portfolios. That's a key tenet of good portfolio management. Also, I think it's fair to believe that the value of the dollar is going to fall. I don't think it's going to fall further against the euro and the pound and the Canadian dollar. It's already done that. But it clearly will fall against the Chinese currency, the Japanese yen, and most Asian currencies. And so I think investors feel, rightly so, that they'll get a nice little tailwind in their investments if they do invest overseas.
Jeff is calling from Boston. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi. 15 years or so ago, I was on the ground managing investment in India and in China. And I disagree about the assessment that in India in particular does not have a strong rule of law. I think that they do. And in both countries, I think that you've got extremely astute investors in both the debt and equity markets.
So when you assess the risk abroad, it doesn't look so bad to you?
Well, in China, it's a little riskier than India, but I don't see the risk as high as it's been portrayed. And, I'm an active investor in both markets.
And are you investing heavily abroad now yourself, Jeff?
Yes, I'm investing much more heavily than I would have before because I know about what's going on the ground.
Do you think this is a long-term good trend for the American economy as part of the global economy?
Well, it depends whether you think an integrated global economy is a good thing or not, whether you're a protectionist. I'm not a protectionist, so I do think that it's a good thing. I think there's a lot of pain involved, but I think it's a good thing in the long run.
Pain for who?
Paying for the adjustment in the manufacturing base and the service base in particular in this country.
Yeah, we see that just today with Whirlpool and Maytag and the talk about more jobs being cut there. Jeff, thanks for your call. Let me get a call from Sumter, South Carolina. Harry's on the line. Hi, Harry. You're on the air.
Hi. I think that the, quote, good economy that so many politicians, especially in the Bush administration, keep talking about is based on debt. public debt and personal debt that is just unsustainable.
And so the money goes where the debt is not. Harry, thanks for your call. James Jampel, how do you see the dynamics at work here?
Well, yeah, I think it's a real important point the last caller made about the debt and what Michael and Mark have said about innovation. If you put them together, I mean, we got to make sure that the benefits to American innovation actually accrue to more than just the slice of the ownership society that by luck or by pluck you've been able to get into, or you've born into that ownership society. If you're not, we have to find out ways. We have to explore ways to make sure that all share in that innovation. Otherwise, we are headed for a lessening of demand here in the United States. If the vast majority of the people here are the so-called zombie consumers, then we
don't have anything left in their pockets. They can't participate. They're not investing in China and India or anywhere much.
Exactly. And I do want to point out that that I think we've seen some consensus about the slide in the dollar here. I think most think that doesn't make it right, mm-hmm. but most think that the dollar will slide. And once you put that into the equation, I mean, I think we realize that one of the reasons the dollar has been propped up is because the Japanese and the Koreans and the Chinese and others really have nowhere else to go right now.
Mm-hmm.
They would like to not have to put everything into the dollar, but there really is no other place to go. But you as an investor don't have that conundrum. So you don't have to follow what the giant governments of Asia are doing. You can actually put your investment dollars somewhere where there isn't that headwind of the falling dollar ahead of you.
Can I jump in right here for
yes,
just a
please.
Second? I don't quite understand why if these large countries, they have to put it into the U.S. because that's the safest place. And they're not going to pile into other places which are not quite so safe. Why shouldn't the same reasoning hold for U.S. investors too, taking in mind the diversification? I mean, I think the risk part is that every time I hear return, I want to put risk at the other side of it.
No, James, how about it?
Yeah, no, and certainly risk figures into the equation. I do think that for your generic American investor, that they're just overweight the United States, and that a way to diversify your risk is to have positions in all these different countries.
But doesn't the return matter for an individual investor who's trying to scrape up to retire one day off their 401k? I mean, China, they don't really care so much if they get 4% or 5%, but for an individual who's now responsible for their own retirement, if it's 4% or 8% or 9%, that's a big deal.
Well, that's exactly right, and that's why you would think that the overseas governments would be more apt to invest in the sort of safer places, which is the perception of the United States. And Mark, that those have a longer investment horizon might want to invest in more heavily overseas.
Mark Sandy, what about the inflation threat out there? If the dollar goes down, we've heard talk recently that, the Chinese prices would then head up. Walmart might not be as cheap. The zombie consumer that James Jampel is talking about may not be able to, have all those cheap consumer goods at hand. Where does that leave capital flow?
Well, I think with a falling dollar, it's logical to conclude that either interest rates will be higher and or inflation will be higher than what we've come accustomed to. So that's part of the process that we're going to go through. And it is going to feel a little bit painful, particularly because we've been the beneficiaries of very low interest rates and very low inflation for quite some time. So this is going to be an adjustment for us, and it's not going to be painless. And so I think that's something we need to anticipate.
I'm still struggling with how the benefit comes back to the American who, as James Jampel says, is not part of the ownership society. So they're not investing a lot in China or anywhere else. Well, they lose their job with Whirlpool.
Right.
The guys who do own shares in their company are investing it some here, but a lot abroad. How does the global economy work to bring benefits back to the great mass of people who aren't big players in this? They're just living in the American economy.
Well, low
interest
rates.
Low
interest rates.
They don't benefit. They get hurt, and that's part of the problem. There are very clear winners and there are very clear losers in this process. And the losers are those that are losing their jobs in global competition. And Whirlpool is a good case in point, the jobs being lost there. And the fact that we as a nation don't think about this very carefully and clearly don't do a good job of designing policy to help these people is a mistake, because ultimately, on net, when you add up all the winners and the losers, we win. And if we can just figure out a way to help the losers a little bit, become a little bit a bigger part of that ownership society, then we'll all be better off.
Michael Mandel
so far,
is saying
we've not done that.
Michael Mandel is saying low interest rates are the payoff.
Two-thirds 2/3 of the U.S. households own their own homes.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody who owns their own home has benefited from the low interest rates, from the influx of money from overseas,
mm-hmm.
which has kept interest rates, which actually they've bought up an enormous amount of mortgage-backed securities.
Right.
So Chinese money has been fueling part of the housing boom here.
So that's a plus for everybody.
That's a direct benefit for that 2/3. Now, the right way to think about this is that roughly about 2/3 of the population is benefiting from that. There is 1/3 which doesn't have any wealth and is not benefiting at all, and that's really where the problem is.
Here's another statistic, I think a more telling one.
Yeah.
The folks that are in the top 10% of the distribution of wealth have a median net worth of about $1 million. That means the difference between their assets mm-hmm. and liabilities is $1 million. That's double what it was 10 years ago. It was $500,000 10 years ago. For the folks in the bottom 40% of the distribution of wealth, their net worth, median net worth, is about $25,000, mm-hmm. and it has not grown a penny in the last 10 years. So that very clearly shows that the distribution of wealth is getting increasingly skewed, and there's many reasons for that, but one of the key reasons is this process of globalization. I'm not saying that should stop the process of globalization. We clearly need to continue on, but we need to figure out a way to ensure that the people at the bottom part of the distribution get their fair share.
Mark, let me ask you just about that then. If for that 10% that's sitting on that nice chunk of change, if they're investing more and more of it abroad, is that potential growth lost to the lower income, lower wealth Americans? Is that going to be building Chinese industrial infrastructure instead of American? Is that a long-term loss here or not?
I don't agree with that perspective for three reasons. First, mm-hmm. We will get returns on those investments.
Well, who's we, Kimo Sabe? Who's we?
The folks in the top part of the distribution,
right.
And that's no problem. Secondly, though, when we invest overseas, that fosters investment in us. And in fact, if you look at investment flows into the United States, direct investment, things like factories and office buildings
yep.
and PC divisions of IBM, we get more than anyone else in the world
yeah.
by far, and that hasn't changed a penny in the past quarter century, and it hasn't changed recently either. So we are enormous beneficiaries of that. And thirdly, you know, as we make our way through this adjustment, as the dollar continues to fall in value, at some mm-hmm. point, and I don't think that's too far off in the future, we become a very attractive place to invest in because businesses all over the world want to be here to export to the rest of the world. In fact, export growth in the U.S. is very strong. It's double digits. So ultimately, we will all benefit. Now, I'm not saying this isn't going to be a bit painful in the interim.
It doesn't that
be,
dropping dollar in particular.
But, there, yeah. but ultimately, we do benefit.
Bo's calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Bo. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Great to have you.
I was motivated to call because I think this apologetics for the deficits is really dangerous and a problem. I wrote an article last year for a mortgage originator, one of the leading industry. Used to be a mortgage broker.
Yeah.
And Paul Volcker is very concerned about this. So just to add his voice to Warren Buffett's, that he said, we're skating on thin ice. As a nation, we're consuming and investing about 6% more than we're producing, and we consume 80% of the net flow of international capital, obviously from China, Japan, and the others. And he wrote that if they lose their appetite for us, more likely than not, it will be financial crisis rather than policy foresight that will force the change. And I think that's right, and we're already seeing it. You know, your experts are talking about the fact that we've got geopolitical stability, but, I mean, so does Canada. And we've seen the investors moving to Canada from the U.S. We've seen China take their yuan off the dollar and take it into a mixed pool of the pound and
right,
the
very recently.
And,
yep.
I think as long as American voters can be bought with tax cuts for their vote, we're never going to get out of this. And the more you have people saying these deficits are not an issue, the worse it's going to be in the long run.
Bo, do you see the flow of investment dollars abroad as a vote of confidence in the global economy, including the U.S., or a vote of no confidence in the American economy?
Obviously, it's no confidence in the crazy fiscal policies and monetary policies that we have. You can't wage a war and cut taxes like they have, and now they're making them permanent. We're digging ourselves deeper into a hole because people are voting because they're selfish and they want their tax cuts, and the Republicans have conned the middle class into thinking that these tax cuts and their policies are going to help them in the long run. It's going to put us all in the hole.
We've got it. Michael Mandel, that's been an issue on Congress just in the last day or two. How do you see the tax cuts and the way they factor into all this?
I don't think the tax cuts are a big deal one way or the other. They affect the distribution of income. They're important in that way. But the people who sort of look at budget deficits as being a big leading indicator, if you go back to the early 1990s, the U.S. had a big budget deficit. France and Germany and Japan didn't. And then you look at economic performance afterwards, you say, look, the country with the big budget deficit ended up doing a lot better. The history here is that the budget deficit on an economic basis turns out to be not a good leading indicator of what's going to happen to the rest of the economy. And I sort of hate to sort of come off as a deficit apologist, but that's not really where the action is. Where the action is if you look at the U.S. companies, if you look at the whole U.S. economy, you say, are we innovative? Are we productive? If we are, we're going to do okay. If we're not, we're going to do terrible. That's really the bottom line here. And sort of focusing on deficits and borrowing and so forth is mistaking the veil of money for the real underlying truth of what's going on the ground.
This is kind of the Bush line. Mark Zandi, please.
Yeah, I would disagree with that. And I don't think the budget deficit today is a problem. $300 billion budget deficit is manageable. The problem is if you do the math, it gets overwhelming in 10 and particularly 20 years. In fact, if nothing changes, if we continue on with current tax policy and spending policies, the budget deficit as share of GDP will be 10%. And even Michael would agree that that's a problem. So the issue is not today, but it's clearly going to be the issue at some point down the road. And to some degree, I think investors do sense this in the fellow who called in just a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
I don't agree with all his conclusions, but he put his finger on what is a very key problem, and that is our fiscal profligacy, which will become more apparent in the years ahead.
I need to just step in right here and just say
please.
One thing, that every other industrialized country has the same long-term fiscal situation as we do. Europe and Japan have worse fiscal situations. So if you're looking on a 20-year basis, you can't just look at the U.S. because everybody else has an aging population and rising health care costs. And so, there's a lot of misinformation going on here.
Michael, China, India, America, Eastern Europe, they don't have the same kind of problems as
China.
Europe,
China's fiscal situation, long-term fiscal situation, they have a faster aging population than we do, and they don't have their pension situation in place yet. So if you sort of looked at China's situation, you actually did the calculations correctly, you could end up with a worse fiscal situation than the U.S. has right now. This is a lot of what's going on right here is people are making economic points, and I'm not saying you, Mark, okay, but people are making economic points for political purposes. And from my point of view, I've been called an apologist for Bush. I've been called an apologist for the Democrats over the years. But the fact of the matter is that the U.S. long-term fiscal situation is not necessarily worse than anybody else's.
That's the way you put it, but I'm not sure it's for political purposes. I think there's real curiosity at best and concern at worst over what's going on. James Gempel, you're the investor among all of us here. You're the guy who's actually placing bets. And your bets, you're saying, are heavily abroad right now. As an American, do you feel like you're placing your bets in a way that's going to benefit this country?
I think it's really the only prudent bets you can make. I mean, you really
overall
you want to be as patriotic as you can be.
But you're not in business for patriotism.
No, and you don't want to be the guy without a seat on a lifeboat. Should we hit the iceberg and the waters are infested with them. Whether we're going to hit them or not, I don't know.
And the lifeboat is foreign investments.
Exactly. Again, I just don't know why you would want to tie up your investments here if your wages are tied up here.
Michael Mandel, you can turn that any way you like, but there's the investor saying the lifeboat isn't here, it's out there.
No, but see, I don't disagree with him. He's sort of making a different point. He's saying that diversification is a good thing. No matter what you think about what's going to happen to the U.S. economy, no matter what you think is going to happen to the global economy, that being diversified is a good thing. And I have to tell you, I agree with that 100%, that diversification is a good idea, but it doesn't have anything to do with whether you think the U.S. is in terrible shape or in great shape. It's prudent to be spread out.
Warren Buffett says it has something to do with that. Is that a political point on his part?
Warren Buffett, as the reporter at the beginning of the show said, Warren Buffett has been over-invested in the U.S.
That's, yep, and so he's diversifying it out.
He's diversifying.
Yeah, we got it. Well, there are exactly the questions and the tensions on the table. It is a new world, as everybody says we're moving in here. We're all trying to get used to it. I'm very grateful to each of you for helping us do that. Michael Mandel at Business Week Magazine. Michael, thanks very much for joining us today.
Oh, so glad to be here.
Mark Zandi at economy.com, chief economist. Mark, thanks for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
And James Gempel, manager at Height Hedge LP. Good luck with your hedge fund, and thanks for being with us, James.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.